The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Wonderful to see so many new people again for beginning instruction. I hope Brooklyn keeps coming on in. My name's Hojin. This is from Selections from Indra's Net. In the ancient Buddhist Hindu legend of Indra's Net, an enlightened king, Indra, stretches an immense boundless net across the universe with an infinity of faceted jewels at every intersection. So if you can imagine this large net cast, and everywhere this net intersects, there's a large jewel. Each jewel is unique, yet reflects all the others, illuminating the principle of interdependence among all living things. So I played hooky this week. I went out on Friday night to a concert, a performance by Meredith Monk, if any of you know her. She's a good friend of the monastery. I met her there back in 1990, did a couple workshops with her. And she has this characteristic of wearing two long braids. And I remember Daido Roshi, my teacher, would take me on some of his art workshops, and we went to Naropa, where Meredith was performing. And I hadn't seen her for a while, but I was in my stall, and somebody was washing their hands, and I was hearing, and I came out and I was like, that's Meredith Monk washing her hands, tuning up. So yes, just always like using her voice and her body for expression. So in this, this was selection from a larger piece called Indra's Net. And I was so moved by it. It's called Anthem, which is a hymn for a world with no borders or boundaries, in which every individual is aware of the commonalities of being a citizen of our planet. It's an affirmation of nature's power, particularly in this time of crisis and upheaval. So this is what she was bringing through her, I don't know, I think it's her 60th, she's 82, so it's her 60th year of performing. So you can imagine how wedded she is to her expression and how clear, much clearer it's getting. So I don't know where this is going exactly, but it's somewhere in this diamond net, which comes from the Avatamsaka, or Flower Ornament Sutra, which is a collection of texts compiled around 500 years after the Buddha died, until about 300 CE. So this vast net on whose every node hangs a glittering diamond. And on the polished surface of this diamond, every other diamond is reflected, multiplying the reflection into infinity. And it's showing what our life is. This is who we are. We are this diamond and this net, which both has its individuality and reflects and reverberates with everything else in the universe. Each diamond exists both in its own right and also connected to every other diamond on the net. And in the 70s, there was this, I guess he was a mathematician or a meteorologist, actually. His name was Edward Norton Lorenz, and he revealed this term he called the butterfly effect. And he used weather as a model. And he showed that even minor environmental fluctuations, like the flapping of a butterfly's wing in France, could set off a distant weather event like a tornado in Kansas. So he was simply confirming what the Buddha had revealed about our self-nature, that we have this incredible influence and effect all the time because we are in this net and it's always connected and moving. Every phenomenon, person, and event is intricately connected and influences the whole. So what does that do to you? What does that make you feel when you realize, like, everything you say, everything, way you act, body, mouth, and your thought has an effect on the whole universe? That's a bit of responsibility there, right? That's what the Buddha's saying, you know. When each of us touch a strand of the net, how we move and act with our body, mouth, and thought, the whole web gets a tremble. So part of what the way she expressed this was so interesting. It was just these small movements. They were her ensemble of sound makers or singers. They weren't really singers, sound makers, would all be sitting in white in a row, and they would just do a small thing with their hand, like this, and everyone did it, and just both hands, right, and just touch lightly the knee of the next person, and then switch to this knee, so you could see the net forming, and then it was like up here, and up here, and up here, and you could just see this net forming. And then an individual would be making a sound, so you would feel one diamond just start, and then that would affect the other diamonds in their movements. And sometimes that would crash or hit each other, or it had different ways it would form and wiggle. And I never saw, like, so there was an ensemble called, with her, called Alarm Sound or Sound Alarm. I can't remember which order, the name of the group. Alarm will Sound. That's the name of the ensemble. And they became the voices too. So the French horn guy was suddenly singing, was making a sound with his mouth. So you couldn't tell throughout the piece what wasn't, the body is an instrument, that each one of them were also an instrument of voice and then an instrument. So when we clearly see these ties that connect us to everything, this should not be constraining, but liberating. The image and the fact of Indra's net is meant to liberate us, to free us from the illusion that we're singular, separate, and solitary. But yet, within this net, of course, we can have a very strong sense of being separate, right? Within this net, the way we've understood ourselves to be. And so, I wanted to say a little bit about this sense of separateness. And this is from The Truth Body by Willa Baker. She wrote this book called Wakeful Body, and it describes how she has come to think of this Buddhist path as waking down, not up, that we need to wake down into our embodiment and through, not up. We've done too much up, we need to go down and through the body. And I could feel that, like, just I was sweeping the sidewalk yesterday, and Edmund planted these incredible hostas out front. I don't know if you saw, but they knew they were in the breeze. We were both all in the breeze, right? And they were just bowing in perfect harmony with the wind, right? Just knew how to go up and down, and And so I was like kind of moving with them, you know, and enjoying. But it was that kind of embodiment of that unifying with that movement. But she says, have you ever been in a full room of people and still felt completely alone? A sense of separateness is something that runs deep in our psyche. It really doesn't have to do with the conditions. It is existential. We believe there is a divide between the self and what the self experiences. The Buddha pointed out that this sense of separateness is related to our belief in the self, so deeply rooted that we never question it. And one of the things practice brings up is, what do we mean by the self? When we look deeply into it, the self is not easy to find as we may think. At first, you might notice a sense of I that exists in the present moment. This sense of self is like a feeling that we exist. There is also a complex and multifaceted sense of identity. There is our name, right? There's our name, there's our job, our relationships. There's our thoughts, our thread of opinions and ideas, our body. This all seems to be part of the self. On the most basic level, there seems to be a consciousness that knows and sees. A sense of I and me, but the more we examine this, the more it falls apart. And in one of his teachings, the Buddha compared this to the self to a chariot, which many of us know. A chariot functions, but if you look closely, there is no one thing that is chariot. It's made up of a bunch of parts. Like if I take the wheel off, is it still a chariot? If I take the planks out, is it still a chariot? Is the seats gone? Is it still a chariot? It's made up of parts. In the same way, there's no one single entity that is the self. It, too, is made up of parts. When Buddha taught selflessness, which we call anatman, that's one of the things unique about Buddhism, is non-self, anatman, right? He did not mean there is no self at all. It is really important that we understand this. Because if we decide there is no self, then we risk diminishing and belittling what is present. And much is present. He meant that the self is not all, is not at all what we think. He meant that the self does not exist as one single thing, right? And does not exist in isolation. Something exists, but there is something, but that something is a construction. So we often say that it's a mental construction. It is a fiber in the web of all life. The self is interwoven with its world. And every breath we take, and exhale is from the trees around us, from the hostas. Every exhale, we join the earth. When we consider deeply, separateness is an illusion. But the illusion of separateness is a powerful one. We know this. It keeps us operating on a level of self-interest. And it also causes us suffering. And the sense of separateness feeds that loneliness, feeds fear. Feeds aversion, grasping. It is not an illusion that serves us well. So how do we kind of operate like in this vastness that's interconnected and know we're not separate and alone? And what keeps us separate and alone is those constructs, those mental constructs that don't understand what this is. And that's what we're working with in practice, is bringing that together. And so when I sit in this with you here in this temple, with Weekly and Sesshin, when I'm on the subway, in the street with many beings, as I look up and feel the open sky and the rain and the wind and the sun and the Hudson River, it draws me to connect and feel all the diamonds in the net continually. That's how I want to look at it. I've learned separateness, but now I just see it's all connected, right? It's just all connected. And when I'm flagging and I lack luster, there's an infusion of this bountiful energy available always. If I can open to it, if I can get out of my head and leave my mind as it is, with the thoughts, with all of it, just using the concentration we're developing in Zazen to see what appearances are, see things appearing. And the next step is that grasping. Don't grasp it. That's hard. This is practice. It's all blooming, blooming. And to let be. It was interesting because more recently I, and this, you know, happens a lot, but sometimes reactions get me, right? For a little while, I'll be like in it. But there was this week a different texture of a reaction that blossomed, but I could feel no, it didn't hook. You know, so the reactions come and then it hooks on some part of ourself that we have drummed up, and it hooks on, and then we'd go with it. And then we're having a full-blown affair, right? But if that hook doesn't find that thing, it just blossoms and gets all reactive and then just moves on, right? And so this is where we need our body and our concentration and our strength that we're developing to see these things appear and disappear. Thich Nhat Hanh had a nice little, we worked with tangles in the art practice online. So he had this part about tangled knots that he speaks of. We speak of it as internal knots or identity complexes, or fetters. And he says, these fetters keep us from being able to be in the present moment. Internal knots are collections of delusion, repression, fear, and anxiety that have been tied in the depths of our consciousness. So it's very deep. We know this. It's very deep. Generational, even. Some of us were talking about how those knots get passed in the body, in the mind. They have the capacity to bind us and to direct us to do, say, and think things that in reality we don't want to say, do, or think, right? Do you ever find that? It's like you do it, and then you're like, why did I do that? I don't want to do that. It's almost like automatic. And that's as our awareness and our strength grows, we can see that appearing, and that's where we begin to change the neuro pathways and open to that vastness more and more. Internal knots are sown and nourished by our lack of mindfulness in daily life. So we know we have to really watch that. And then the chief 10 internal knots are, I should say, give a shout out. What's your top, Casey's top 10, you know, of internal, chief internal knots, okay? The three poisons, right? Greed, this anger, hatred, delusion, ignorance, conceit, suspicion, attachment to the body as self, extreme views and prejudices, clinging to rites and rituals, our craving for immortality, and our craving to keep everything just as it is. Our health and our happiness depend to a great extent on our ability to transform these he says 10 fetters. I think my list might be a little bit longer. But anyway, mindfulness is really the tool we're using, which has the capacity to recognize these internal knots when they appear in our consciousness. That's what we can do. Right? We're a creature that has the ability to study itself, to be conscious of itself. And he says, too, these habit energies are transmitted by our parents and grandparents. He says, we don't need to go back into the past and dig into memories as they do in psychology, which is important sometimes. Do psychologists know that? That's what keeps you in going. In order to discover the roots of these troubled, tangled parts of the mind, the energy of mindfulness has the capacity to recognize internal formations when they manifest themselves and to look deeply into them, so we're able to see the roots of these tangled knots, even though we don't have to know exactly why or where. We know they're there. So, we don't have to be hijacked. So Lama Willa also said that she speaks about this waking down, which I wanted to share her words on that, if I can find it in my vast collection of notes here. let me see. Yes. She said, waking down does not mean just shifting attention to the area below your neck, not just the hara, but it means exploring the wisdom of your embodied experience from the physical to the sensory and from the sensory to the emotional and from the emotional to the energetic, from the energetic to the conscious. So this is to make us come conscious. It's about exploring the sacred world of feeling, breath, and sensation that's already present. We can spend, and I think this is kind of the crux of it, we can spend many years meditating and gathering profound insights. We can be inspired by noble ideas and aspirations. These insights, ideas, and aspirations might be powerful, but they can also remain locked in a conceptual box. If truths that we know with the conceptual mind, or that we glimpse with intuition, do not make it in and down into the body and nervous system, we won't really live them. Right? So we can be touched by words and ideas and really powerful, our aspirations, but it really has to wake down through the body and our nervous system, and then to feel the rest in that, like the rest that begins to develop as we're maturing in our practice, that our body gets it and can hold it. Because the body picks up the mind habits and rushes around, and we move so fast, we're not catching it, especially when we're filled all the time with language in our ears, music, our own world. So when we open that up and we like take the plugs out for a moment and just like, you know, feel the wind and like just the air on our skin and smells, and we're not locked in, like our body begins to be able to feel its nervous system and live these things that were so inspiring. It metabolizes. The path of waking down does not transcend, but it metabolizes, it alchemizes. I like that word. It shapeshifts us. She says, you don't need to leave anything behind. In fact, you can't leave anything behind because your humanness is part of you. Rather, on the path of waking down, you are experiencing right here and right now, and that's enough. It's more than enough. the here and now is very the very stuff of liberation. So we can, as we practice, we can keep seeing and trusting more and more this direct experience, and that mind is embodied, is interpenetrating with our physical and energetic dimensions that we call the body. Now, in the Zen tradition, there's an expression when one becomes a teacher that they're wearing the iron yoke. I can tell you from my physical and direct experience, that is true. It feels like you're wearing an iron yoke. And a yoke has very heavy connotations, of course, figuratively, because it's what oxen would wear, how you can control the ox to plow the field. They would wear this iron yoke. So it has this sense of being subservient or this heavy burden to direct as oppressive burden. So I asked my friend about the word yoke. She's in yoga. And she said, the Sanskrit term for yoke, she said, yoke. She said, it's like the union between a practitioner and the divine. And I was like, oh, I take refuge in this yoke. This union between a practitioner and the divine. And that's far richer than thinking of it as this heavy burden. It's definitely more in alignment with the diamond net of Indra. So I take refuge in this alignment, in this yoke with the interdependence, or as Thich Nhat Hanh called it, the interbeing. And it helps immensely with the willingness to wear this iron yoke. But it's not just mine, I realized. But we all wear an iron yoke as a bodhisattva in our way of vowing, in a sense, to be of benefit in this world, to save living beings. That's a yoke. You don't turn away from yourself or from others. We connect with that. We wear it as a welcome to the truth of this body. This truth body that is interconnected. We don't turn away. So in a sense, we all have this yoke, this divine, between the practitioner and the divine. We're connected with this divine diamond net of Indra. It's a welcome to our human beingness, this formless field of benefaction. And a lot of the elements of that we can trace back to the stars. That's how vast it is. And that we all come from this uncreated source and gather as these elements, as this chariot, this bigger truth body, Indra's net, creates our mutual inescapability. And also, it presents an ever-present important challenge, which I heard Ayo at Yatundi speak of in a course I attended with her, speaking of her book on the Diamond Net of Indra. And it was called Casting Indra's Net. And she says, we are conceived into the net, born into it, and exist within it. We will die in its entanglements. In the meantime, can we enhance the ways we live in this vast and abundant community of kin, near and far? That's the challenge. Can we enhance the ways we live in this vast and abundant community of kin, near and far? Yeah. There's a story about Milarepa, which I loved, which he was a yogi and a meditation master in Tibet, and he was liberated through motion. And he was studying the Dharma for many years. It was in caves, long retreats in caves. Can you imagine? Imagine like doing that. Some of us be like, yeah, I want to do that. But a long retreat in a cave with no one but spiders, and we think there's no one, but suddenly you find out you are not alone, whether it's in your head or crawling around. Anyway, he, before departing, he went to see his teacher, who was Marpa. Marpa was a farmer, so worked very close to the earth. And as a parting gift, Marpa gave Milarepa kind of something like a mezuzah inside a mezuzah, there's a scroll. So they gave him, he gave him a little amulet with a scroll inside, sealed. And he said to his beloved disciple, "You have my blessings for your retreat in the mountains." Usually when you go on retreat, even like a week of hermitage, you stop in with your teacher to see if they have anything to offer as you go off by yourself. It's just a week, you know, and you're like, you know, 100 feet from the monastery, but you feel like you're out there, right? He says, however, a time will come when things are hard and you will find it difficult to practice meditation. When that time comes, open the amulet. So Milarepa took it, and he had a big bun on his head, and he put it inside his bun. And he rolled it back up, and he meditated for years in this rocky caves on mountain cliffs. Ate only nettles. Can you imagine your diet of nettles? And there are ups and downs, but overall he made progress in his spiritual development. And then one day he woke up, like many of us do, unable to meditate. Some of you that have sat a while, have you had that feeling? You sit, and then one morning you get up and you're like unable to meditate. Just something is out of sorts. So he was out of sorts. He was weak, got weak. He got exhausted. And day after day, he tried all the remedies he knew to clear up his obstacle, and nothing worked. Sound familiar? Eventually, he became discouraged and prepared to give up his meditation practice. And as he prepared to leave retreat, he remembered his teacher's parting words. And he thought, the amulet in my bun! After all these years, he had never taken it out. So he, it's like finding missing glasses that were always like on top of your head, you know? Oh, there they are. I remember Yun and I, both of us with our glasses. And Yun is like, have you seen my glasses? And they're like, right here. Like, yep, right there, you know. Anyway, so he unwound his long hair and he opened up the amulet for the first time. And inside was that scroll of paper. And he unrolled it, expecting to find more obstacle clearing prayers that were going to pull him through, and rituals, or perhaps a secret technique of meditation he hadn't learned yet. Instead, on the paper was illustrations of bodily poses, movements, along with instructions on just breathing, stretching, moving, and detailed descriptions of yoga postures, a recipe for liberation through movement. That's what his teacher sent him when he was in that hard time to go for that, and it was about moving. After this, Milarepa's obstacles cleared. He began to integrate body and movement into his daily practice. And later he declared to his disciples, this was the key to his enlightenment. Maybe this moment comes for all of us. Milarepa had been missing the body's moving wisdom. so that we don't miss our body's moving wisdom, that we're not up here all the time. The body is a hearth where a fire of wisdom burns within. It's not exotic knowledge, and it doesn't depend on a specific kind of movement. It's just how do we, does stillness move? It depends on developing a trusting relationship to our body and what we do internally while we're moving. And of course, we hear a lot in our practice, can we do what we're doing while we're doing it? So this is very simple. When we get caught up in so much of the world and how that distresses us, and we get stuck and depressed, we can keep doing that, and it doesn't, and it's there. We know it's there. It's not like we leave anything out, but some things we need to do with our body wisdom. Just run while we're running. Just walk while we're walking. And this is where the concentration's needed, because we can go right into the habit mind of going back to all that line of entanglement that we know so well. But this is where we're practicing. It's like, can I just walk? And let that make rest in that. Like, find the rest. I do that, like, you know, we were talking about it, like you find yourself like rushing somewhere and you realize you don't really have to. I find, like, you know, Goka and I were talking about it, how like I'm walking to, you know, one of the buildings and I'm like, foom, 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 because I'm thinking about, like, I got a half an hour in caretaking and sesshin and all this that I got to get to, and I totally missed that I walked there. And so I was like, we were talking about, like, just finding that rest in our step, and like just as much got done, even more space, less anxiety. So, if there is one aim in practice, I think it is this somatic intimacy and trusting flowers to the wind and birds to time. The results of freely giving is the manifestation of unconditional giving, Dogen says. Giving to ourself, giving to this entrusting, this power of entrusting ourself to the wind, to time. Master Dogen is quoted as teaching, body and mind are not separate in Buddha Dharma. This being so, they are also called body, heart, mind. One word. Shinjin Ichi Niyo, the oneness of body and mind, body, mind, heart. This will take some time. That's practice, intention, compassion, and action. So really it's somatic intimacy is bringing it into life. Otherwise, it just doesn't go anywhere. So, as we're practicing, it's to bring it to life, into action. I'll end with a poem by Saraha, and Saraha's name, it's another Tibetan name, is called the arrow. It refers to the one who has shot the arrow of non-duality into the heart of duality. So we can think of ourselves as these archers. The one who has shot the arrow of non-duality into the heart of our duality. And was also a poet, Saraha. Holy places, shrines, and altars. I've been all over in my travels. But I have never seen a place of pilgrimage more blissful than the body. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.